The Tale of the Frozen Pussy, Slip or Trip, The $1 Million Fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will hear on Miami Memoirs. Join Florida attorney Louis Ress as he recounts his 6 decades of legal practice in the wilds of South Florida.
Hi everyone, I'm here with Louis Rez, and we're on episode 16, Super Lawyers, of the podcast Miami Memoirs, Strange Cases and Wild Tales. Louis, this episode is called Super Lawyers. What is that all about?
Okay, and this is Louis Rez, and I'm here with Jeanette Garcia talk about Super Lawyers. And it's, of course, these subjects are very interesting to me. I hope they're interesting to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knows much about the creation of the concept of being a super lawyer, but like there was Clarence Darrow. Years ago in the United States, it was the attorney in the Scopes monkey trial, the question of Darwinism or whether it was religion that created man or whether man evolved from apes.
Uh-huh.
And it was a famous case. Of course, that case was lost by the plaintiff, and it was determined that God created man.
Huh.
In those days, that was very important.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was a super lawyer. Super lawyers, they're the superstar lawyers, the ones that you hear on television. They're on the panels. You see them on CNN and Fox News.
Mm-hmm.
And they give expert opinions, Dershowitz, that crowd.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I told my father that I was not going to be a super lawyer. And he said, if you have to be a mediocrity, be the best one. So that was my father.
Yeah.
But what makes a superstar lawyer? These are superstars. Marketing is the answer. Well, Clarence Darrow didn't have marketing, but he had the newspapers and the media in those days.
Mm-hmm. He didn't plan on it, but it worked out for him.
Right.
Yeah.
He was a great orator. But it's not great talent or meticulous work that makes you a super lawyer. Super lawyers write books the way I did, but those books are usually ghostwritten.
Mm-hmm.
I write them. They're self-lauding. They're self-promoting people. They lecture at educational seminars, but the material is generally researched and prepared for them. They send out newsletters, which are generally written by others for them.
Mm-hmm.
They advertise in bar journals and on billboards and especially on TV, but that's often done through an advertising agency. And they boast about their successes. They're braggarts. They promote themselves to be consultants for television stations. They use the internet and offer fact kits and materials to attorneys in order to seek referrals that the attorney would send them cases. And then they go through the cases and they only pick ones that they can win. A real lawyer faces challenges and undertakes cases sometimes that they know they're going to lose.
Mm-hmm.
But the person needs representation.
Yes.
Or they have to lessen the exposure or the loss or cushion the effect on the client.
Mm-hmm.
Can't win them all. And when you pick only winners, it's not like boxing where there's a champion and you have to win every match.
Yeah.
The law is entirely different. It's like you can't say to a doctor, you only take patients that you can cure and don't take anyone that can have a complication or die. That's not practicing
medicine.
That's
not why you're a doctor, or a lawyer.
That's the difference.
Mm-hmm.
So they use the internet, and much of their solicitation is subcontracted to publicity consultants. Clerks cull out the financially rewarding cases, and young associates sign up the clients. They use dummy law firms and non-lawyers to solicit cases through TV ads and phone-in phone numbers. For example, you've seen it on television.
Mm-hmm.
If you've had complications from mesh surgery, call us. You may have a claim for a large sum of money. Operators are standing by.
Oh, yeah. Those are everywhere. On the radio.
Right.
Yeah, billboards, on buses, everywhere.
And there's another one. To all former NFL players, football players, you may have brain damage. Call us at so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
Or another one. Are you suffering from lung cancer? Have you smoked or worked in a factory where asbestos was used? You may be entitled to a large sum of money. Call now.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I was offered the defense of all the asbestosis cases in Florida, and probably going to lead to the entire country, and it wouldn't have required my putting on about 10 lawyers just to handle those cases.
Yeah.
And that's still being litigated 25 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good financially, and they're entitled to representation, but it's a very stultifying thing to do, to keep fighting and fighting the same defenses over and over. But that's how it is. every one of these cases that the plaintiffs solicit, the defendants have to counter.
Mm-hmm.
The super lawyers become theatrical performers. They self-promote, not just locally. They like to fly in the private jets, and they often dress differently than you and I. Two of these gentlemen always wear big Stetson cowboy hats and high-heeled cowboy boots, even though they live in the city, and the boots and hats serve no purpose other than to make them seem taller. They are the rhinestone cowboys of the law.
So do you know any of these personally? I'm sure you've bumped into a few of them at least.
Yeah, I can tell you about two of them.
Okay.
One, Dennis Phillips. Well, that's not his real name.
Yeah.
But he was a local celebrity, Dennis, and there was hardly a television panel or a radio show that discussed pending criminal cases that didn't include Dennis. He was the champion of the underdog. You remember the case, Ricky Saporta, the case where the young defendant killed his parents, and Dennis came up with the defense of television intoxication. Well, Dennis started to appear on radio shows, television newscasts, and he gave interviews, and he was featured in the local newspapers. He gave speeches wherever he could be heard about the validity of his new criminal defense theory, television intoxication. Too much TV watching equals mental imbalance equals insanity.
Wow.
If one watches too much television, violence comes accepted and you become intoxicated by it.
Did he actually win?
No.
On that?
Okay. That's not what he was trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't interested in winning. He was interested in self-promotion and publicity.
And the glamour of it.
Right. And, of course, watching TV doesn't absolve you from your criminal behavior.
Mm-hmm.
He created his own pseudoscience, and he had hack experts. And in those days, you could get people who were expert in anything, and they could come up with any kind of theory and say it was science, and it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
It was baloney. And the jury convicted his client. But Dennis was famous. Then there was Dennis's Twinkie defense. If you eat too many Twinkies, those delicious chocolate cakes, you became insane and not responsible for your acts. And he called it sugar psychosis.
Well, I think I've had some sugar psychosis in my time.
Well, the jury convicted again. But Dennis became even better known nationally now. I was representing insurance companies. I defended an automobile accident case in which Dennis was the plaintiff's attorney. I had this super lawyer. He had associates appear at the pretrial depositions, motions, and conferences. He would make his grand appearance at the trial. I had a pretty strong liability defense. His client had turned left immediately in front of our car. Even though the front of our car struck the side door of his car, we had no time to stop. They pulled right in front of us.
Hmm.
They failed to yield the right of way. They claimed that we were speeding and could have easily avoided the collision and certainly contributed to it. The injuries weren't really severe. The day of the trial arrived, I had taken our client driver down to the courthouse for two dress rehearsals in a real courtroom, which had been vacant. I placed him on the real witness box and questioned him and then cross-examined him. On the second occasion, he was grilled by my associate. I repeated the rehearsal three times. We cross-examined him about the skid marks, the location of the debris from the collision, the extent of the physical damages. He was asked to estimate the time that expired between the point at which he first noticed the other vehicle until the point of contact.
Mm-hmm.
He marked the point of collision on a diagram of the intersection. He gave estimates of his own speed as well as the speed of the other car. The testimony was consistent with the accident report filed by the police, and the distances traveled by each vehicle after the impact coincided with his description. So he can identify the other car and describe it, the color, the make, the model, and he could point out the other driver and identify him. He knew what he had been wearing. He knew what to expect. His testimony was consistent, and it dovetailed with our reconstruction expert. That's someone that comes in mm-hmm. and gives the theory of how the accident happened from an engineering point of view.
Mm-hmm.
He knew how to listen to the question, and he understood what was being asked and not to rush to answer. That gives me time to object. Good. I told him, we're not playing beat the clock here. Count to three before you answer. Listen to our objections because we're guiding you. We practiced that too, and we also practiced handling questions from out of the ballpark, like, you admitted causing the accident to the police officer at the scene, didn't you?
Hmm.
And of course, the main thought was, don't rush to answer. Again, we're not playing beat the clock. Give us a chance to object.
Is that usually the case, Lewis? Like, you should take your time?
Right. People think that they're so anxious to mm-hmm. be believed and to get their theories out and their answers out, they rush.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to see how fast they can get it out. And that's the big mistake because They had a, we tell them, repeat the question to yourself a second time. Make sure you understand the question before you answer it. If you don't know the answer, don't guess. Don't answer. Just say, I don't understand the question. When you say, I don't understand the question, it's a flag to us to help you out. Then we'll say, why don't you explain what you're asking our client? And listen to what we're doing.
So, yeah, and a lot of times if they don't stop and think, they might maybe, you
blow
know,
the whole case.
Be impulsive in their answer or say the wrong thing, say too much.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Like the president says, it is what it is. You don't do that. Don't say things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Our primary defense was that the other car pulled right in front of us and we could not stop or avoid it. We were ready. We met in our office in the morning, 2 hours before the time set for trial. The client was ready. We were ready. Our experts were on telephone call. Our team went down to the courthouse. Our associate, our trial secretary, and the client were with me. We walked with confidence to the table marked defense on the left side of the courtroom, beyond the banister, and we opened our briefcases and put our files and yellow pads on the table. It was 9:05. No Dennis Phillips.
Oh.
The proper courtesy is to call opposing counsel's office and find out what's happening. Maybe he was in an accident on the way down, or maybe he was sick. At 9:10, there was no answer. We tried again at 9:15, then again at 9:30. At 9:30, I was called into the judge's office. How are you, Mr. Ress? I said, just fine, Your Honor, but I can't find Mr. Phillips. Don't worry, he won't appear. Draw an order dismissal with prejudice. I said, Judge, he may be able to explain, and he may be able to refile. With prejudice means you can't refile. Mm. The judge says, son, he says, just draw an order dismissing with prejudice. Close your file. You'll never hear from him again.
Oh.
I said, judge was right. The last time I saw Dennis was at a 10-kilometer foot race, and he waved to me. That was the end of him.
And you know any other ones?
Oh, yeah.
Any
there's another
stories?
One. I call him Sandy Simon, and anyone who reads that will know who I'm talking about.
Huh.
He was from Hollywood, and he was the number one trial lawyer in Southeast Florida. He's passed on. He was wild in court. I don't think he himself could tell right from wrong, and he didn't care. He would yell and scream and rant and rave and conduct a theatrical performance, and he got away with it. Judges generally left him alone. He donated and raised large sums of money for their election and re-election campaigns. He served on their committees. He knew all the county commissioners, state senators, and the governor. He had a stable of medical specialists, including professors, lecturers, and traveling professional witnesses. His reconstruction experts were very creative. He used visual aids, huge graphic blow-up photographs, which other attorneys couldn't get past the judge because they were prejudicial, and he used expensive medical exhibits. His trial-experienced accountants would come up with huge sums for economic damages, which no one else could get through to the jury. The judge would strike that kind of testimony. He sued large corporations, insurance companies, and hospitals for vehicle collisions, product liability, and malpractice, often in class actions, and always looked for proposed punitive damages. That's punishing, exemplary damage, to make an example out of them.
Sounds like quite the guy.
Yeah, he was. He brought in jury evaluation experts who would get a list of proposed jurors in advance and research their backgrounds. As the jurors were being interviewed by the attorneys, these experts would watch for facial expressions and body language and guide you as to whether or not the jury would be sympathetic. He brought in large verdicts, huge verdicts. As Sandy made more and more money, he built his own building and with a recreated courtroom, complete with a high ceiling, state and United States flags, a raised platform for the judge, a witness stand, and a jury box. Actually, it was just like the real courtroom. And he would put the clients on the stand the way I was doing, but I used a real courtroom. He had his own. And he would conduct entire mock trials, often having assistants bring in paid jurors from the streets. Sandy tried the case 2 or 3 times before they went to the real courtroom, and his team evaluated the practice jurors' comments and adjusted their presentation of the case. There's a great benefit from rehearsals, as any musician or anyone in show business will tell you.
Yeah, no, he definitely had an upper hand with that technique.
So you didn't know about mock trials?
No, no.
We did that, and I did that too, when I had the big cases. Even for the insurance industry, I would pay, and we would practice 2 or 3 times with our witnesses.
Very smart.
The Aetna Casualty Insurance Company asked me to defend one of Sandy's cases. He screamed and yelled and coached during the depositions. You know, don't answer that question, and we've already, and then he answered it, and he supplied the information. The case involved the death of a Gulfstream racetrack manager. He was the manager of the track caterer. Harry M. Stevens was the name of the caterer, and he was found beaten to death in the storm.
Yeah.
Although there wasn't enough for a criminal charge, and no one knew who did it, Sandy was suing the racetrack because they were the owners of the property based on inadequate security. The attack had come during normal business hours, and security really wasn't an issue. Inadequate locks or lighting didn't have anything to do with this assault. But the judge was friendly to Sandy, and he denied our motion for summary judgment. I moved to throw it out. And he allowed the case to go to trial before the jury. It appeared to me that we could win this case, and we would win the case. My reports went to the adjuster and the supervisor at the Aetna Casualty. The case should be tried. That's what I said. On the eve of the trial, I was called off, and the case was settled for some crazy high amount. Oh, the benefit of publicity.
Yeah, anyway. I mean, I'm pretty sure the fact that he helped out the judges and he was, you know, well-connected in that sphere helped. I mean, is that really allowed? Like, can lawyers be, isn't that a conflict of interest for lawyers to be partial to or assist judges or show favor to them?
Well, as a matter of fact, it's a great source of a problem because the judges who run for re-election or when they get elected in the first time, have committees, and they have to raise money for their posters.
Exactly.
And all
of that.
And
you can't really control where that money's coming from.
And a lot of that money comes from trial lawyers who practice before them.
Mm-hmm.
So when they're elected to the bench, they may appoint that lawyer to be a trustee of an estate or something.
Right.
Or in a bankruptcy, to be a trustee for the bankrupt and make big fees.
Mm.
Also, a judge has a huge discretion in allowing exhibits in cases and trials. So if it's in the judge's discretion, there's no appeal. The judge says, I think this is highly prejudicial and will inflame the jury, and you can't get your pictures in.
Wow.
And the judge says, yeah, your pictures are okay, to the one who's friendly with. He says, I don't think these will inflame the jury.
That's,
and he lets
crazy
them in.
To me.
And the appellate court's not going to decide what will inflame or not inflame a jury. And look at the pictures.
In your opinion, is there anything that could be done to sort of curtail this problem, this issue, and prevent this sort of favoritism?
There are a lot of problems built into the judicial system. And a lot of the lawyers complain that the judicial system is terrible, but it's the best ones. It's the best of what there is, but they all have flaws.
Mm.
So anyhow, Sandy was one of the Florida lawyers who was asked to represent the state against the tobacco companies.
Huh.
And why? Because he was a famous super lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And the attorneys who represented the state of Florida received millions of dollars in attorney's fees.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I decided to send the case to Sandy. I thought it could be won, and the damages were significant. I was very busy at the time, and I wanted to see how Sandy would perform. After the case had dragged on for a long time, I received a letter, not a phone call, that he had lost the case.
Huh.
And by the way, Sandy had to start his Rolls Royce the remote control, because he made a few enemies along the way, and he didn't want to be killed sitting in the driver's seat if a bomb went off. So much for super lawyers. I'm just a mediocrity. Sorry, Dad.
Well, good for you. I mean, you didn't have to deal with, I'm sure, some of the backlash that he received. And if you're scared about, you know, death threats, I'm sure you've done some damage. So, wow. Interesting people you mentioned here. Is there anything else you can tell us? I'm sure the gentleman in the O.J. Simpson trial is also sort of notorious for being a super lawyer, right?
That's another famous one. Johnny Cochran was his name.
Johnny Cochran.
And he formed law offices all over the country. After that, he opened these law offices, and they advertised Johnny Cochran law offices, but he was never there.
Mm-hmm.
And they handled a lot of plaintiff's work. Johnny Cochran had his own airplane, too. The same kind of super lawyer. So he's defending O.J. Simpson.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you, I wasn't impressed by the prosecution at all.
Hmm.
And so the first thing he says, remember this, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
famous words.
If you think about that, that is, they take the old gloves. that were exhibits in the case.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called opening the door. Once they start playing around with those gloves and trying them on, the plaintiff then can go back and do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they take these gloves that had been wet, that had shriveled and shrunk. I don't know if you remember what they looked like. And he says, well, put these on. Well, OJ, first of all, had arthritis of his hand. Nobody knows this.
Mm. So he had probably swelling. And
they told him, don't take your medicine for the arthritis. Oh. So his hand swelled up. That's number one.
Yeah.
And of course, the prosecution wasn't smart enough to say, let me see your hands. Mm-hmm. You have arthritis? Did you have arthritis at the time? Were you taking medication?
They would have gotten him there.
They were pretty naive. Then the second thing was, the glove was all shriveled up and had mm-hmm. shrunk.
Mm-hmm.
The prosecution should have pulled out a pair of fresh gloves, the same size, and say, here's the manufacturer sitting out here. These are identical gloves.
Lewis, you were the one that was supposed to be there.
Slip these gloves on Mr. O.J. Simpson and see if they fit.
Mm-hmm.
And they can object all they want. They opened the door mm-hmm. and they would have had them.
They should have hired you instead.
Well, you don't have to be a genius to figure some of these things out. And also, they didn't ask him whether he had practiced putting on those gloves with the attorney before.
Hmm.
Because no attorney worth his salt or her salt mm-hmm. would ever do an experiment in court unless they knew the outcome.
Yes.
In fact, I had a rule, no experiments in court. None. My firm didn't do any experiments
mm-hmm.
in court because you never knew how it would turn out. But when they're going to do that and say, put your hand in the glove, they had practiced that before, I'm sure, 2, 3, 4 times to make sure that his hand wouldn't fit in there.
Yep.
They weren't taking chances.
No.
The plaintiff, the prosecution never said, did you practice this with your attorney before? They didn't do that.
What do you think went wrong there with the prosecution?
I think the prosecution they're not the most brilliant lawyers, and they get very minimal salaries,
mm.
and they look to get judgeships. That's their goal, most of them.
Mm.
And a trial practice. You're out there fighting for your life every day
hmm.
and under tremendous pressure, and it's not the same as being a salaried state prosecutor.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean to offend prosecutors. Some of them are great, but they tend to also be narrow and have a separate profession, prosecutor.
Hmm.
So it's different from the private trial practice.
Yeah.
Anyhow, tell you more about self-promotion
mm-hmm.
and these lawyers, what they do with the it's like, you ever hear of Buffalo Bill Cody, Wild Bill Cody?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah.
He was like that. So Muhammad Ali, he was a self-promoter, but he was number one.
Yeah.
And Buffalo Bill Cody put on one hell of an Indian show, you know,
mm-hmm.
Wild West show. Custer, remember Custer? Custer's Last Stand.
Yes.
Well, he got on his horse and rode up and down in front of the enemy lines. They were all shooting at him
mm-hmm.
to put on a show. George Patton, you know who he was?
Yes.
To General Patton. He walked around with a set of six shooters on his hips.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the one that said, your job is to kill the other son of a bitch before he kills you. He was a tough guy.
Yeah.
So, a lot of these attorneys are rated like the best lawyers. They have magazines, best lawyers in Florida. You've seen them.
Mm-hmm.
Best lawyers in
mm-hmm.
the country. Well, you pay for that. You take an ad. Or you join a group and you pay for a certification. Trial Lawyers of America.
Mm-hmm.
Million dollar club. I had a $1 million fee and they wouldn't take me because I didn't pay them to join the club.
Mm-hmm.
You had to buy a membership and then they put your name out.
It's not by merit. It's...
And they do billboards. They do a lot of radio advertising.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, you can only have a business card, but now they have all these things. Awards. If you want an award, you donate money. So you donate money to the, let's say, the Civil Liberties Union, which is a wonderful thing. You donate $50,000, and you say, I'm donating this money, but I would appreciate recognition. And suddenly you get the Lawyer of the Year Award.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because you're
giving
the money.
It's all the money, yeah.
They create their own organizations. The International Society of Trial Lawyers. There's no such thing. They made it up. and they become the first president.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have a seal and a book and a certificate, and they advertise that you've been elected to the International Society of Trial Lawyers. I've got some of them here, American Trial Lawyers Association.
Yeah.
But some of them are pretty responsible.
Mm-hmm.
And then they rate you. So the ratings, there's a company called Martindale & Hubbell. They started it out, and they have a very high level of integrity, and they check with the judges, and they check with other lawyers. To get an A rating from Martindale & Hubbell is very significant.
Mm-hmm.
Used to be hard. Used to be there maybe five in the whole county of Dade County that would get them.
Now it's more common.
And now it's a lot easier to get the A rating. But I had that back in 1956. I had that, I think.
And would you say that that's like the best standard to go by?
I think so. Yeah. Martindale & Hubbell's good. Then you had foundations. You create your own foundation, and you can create your own Man of the Year award from your foundation. Oh, he's the Man of the Year.
Yep.
Then they have materials that they prepare for trial lawyers, guides and so on. It's all done for them. So about 20% of low-income families find a lawyer from TV ads.
Hmm.
Mostly low-income families.
Yeah.
They spend, last year, the lawyers spent over $200 million on television ads.
True.
I think it's closer to $1 billion.
Ooh.
And I would say right nowadays, 75% of all law firms advertise.
Yeah.
So you know, that's how they do it.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be illegal. Now,
oh, really? It used
yeah.
to be illegal to advertise?
Yeah. I'll tell you about that. There was a famous case called Bates versus Arizona. It was in 1977 that they changed it. And American Bar Association always said that it was illegal. But you didn't have to be a member of the American Bar Association to practice in any state. But they set mm-hmm. high standards, and a lot of the states followed the Bar Association's recommendations.
Uh-huh.
And they said that the only thing you could do is have a letterhead and a personal card. And you couldn't even say that you were admitted in more than one state. You could only say the state you were practicing
wow,
in.
Wow, yeah, that's very strict.
It was very strict. And then they had this case in Bates versus Arizona. And it was the Arizona bar. It was very interesting. What they did was Bates was trying to reach out and serve the community. And they meant well, he and his partner. And they were doing title insurance for small houses where the banks were charging a lot of money. They would write the title insurance for a lot less. They would handle closings.
Yeah.
They would draw a simple will.
Mm-hmm.
Florida had a suggested minimum fees, the Florida bar, and suggested was in quotes, because if you didn't charge the minimum fees, they could report you and file a claim. Other lawyers could report you for undercutting their fees.
Interesting.
They did away with that
yeah.
because it was found to be unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. They didn't do away with it voluntarily.
Hmm.
Anyhow, Chief Justice Warren Burger, as I recall, made the decision in the Bates case that the practice of law was subject to the Sherman Antitrust Act, and therefore lawyers were engaging in a trade or commerce.
Hmm.
And once lawyers were engaged, just like corporations,
that
then you had
the right
First Amendment and freedom
right.
of speech, and so you could do anything. Now, they tell you the dollar amounts of the recoveries. You can get endorsements from clients. They could never. I mean, that was an outrage.
Mm-hmm.
They had an endorsement from, and Chief Warren Burger was really upset. The Washington Redskins, you'll pardon the word Redskins, but at that time, that's what they were known
mm-hmm.
as. Their fullback, John Riggins, who was famous, John Riggins, he got on television or radio or something and endorsed a law firm in one of these interviews for, you know, money.
Uh-huh.
And Justice Warren Burger heard about it. He said he would never go to a law firm who was recommended like that.
Huh.
He was outspoken. It was terrible.
Yeah, some people still held on to the integrity of not doing that. But I feel
right.
like nowadays it's like normalized. You
well,
see it so
it
much
is,
that it's
right.
sort of it's part of the norm.
Right.
If you
right.
don't advertise, then how are you going to get any business?
Well, and they have endorsement from clients. And
yep.
they use actors.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't able to use actors originally.
Mm-hmm.
The ads resemble legal documents. You're not allowed to show that. Here's the release or here's the check for $1 million or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They use nicknames. Johnny the Giant Killer will be your attorney. they use irrelevant characteristics. You know, he's smooth, he's sharp, he's the best. He'll work for you. He's up nights working for you. And they show a picture of a law office at midnight with the lights on. they're working for you.
Do you think that gradually got worse?
Yes.
Like with time, it sort of escalated.
The minute they said, you had freedom of speech and you could advertise. So then immediately the local bar association said, you can advertise, but we're going to tell you the limits.
Right.
It has to be professional, ethical.
Yes.
It has to be truthful and so on. And now it's getting worse and worse and worse. Then they have class actions. They have stuff where they advertise. And I was telling you, weed killers, asbestos, tobaccos, automobiles, airbags, design. Remember the Ford Pinto cases where they put the fuel tank in the motor?
Oh, gosh.
The whole thing was exploding. And then the Boy Scouts. If you're in the Boy Scouts, you're molested. The Catholic Church come in. Mm-hmm. We'll represent you against the church. If you have hernia mesh, if you... have a hip implant, the type of implant, it's the wrong type of metal, breast implants, leaking. That's all part of what's going on in the law practice. It's become a big industry.
Definitely,
the super lawyers are right up there soliciting. And when you call in on these things, you don't get a lawyer. You get a telephone operator that sends you to a clerk that takes down the information. And then it's culled out. It's like a net, and the small fish are thrown back. They don't want them. Only the big fish are taken out of the net, and then you move up to the next level. Finally, you meet with the lawyer, and then they sign your case up, and then the big firm that actually handles the case starts to look at it. It's all culled out, thinned out for them.
Yeah.
And it's all money.
It's a business.
You like that?
Yeah.
And that's what
I learned a lot. I don't like that. Usually you give me news that I don't like. But I'm learning.
Well, today you learned that the court said that the law practice is a business.
Yes.
And once you do that,
it's
tough. It's no longer an elegant, refined profession.
Yeah, integrity goes out the window.
Right.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Lewis. I learned quite a bit. And we'll see you next time on our next episode.
Okay.